fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that's how it goes. Everybody knows. And everybody knows that it's now or never. Everybody knows that it's me or you. And everybody knows that you live forever. Oh, when you've done a line or two. Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. And everybody knows. And everybody knows that the plague is coming. It's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman are just a shining artifact of the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. Everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through. From the bloody cross on top of Calvary to the beach in Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming upon. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Oh, everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes.
and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear this program on axissacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, and we're on Facebook. Today's program is A Long View of Climate Change Solutions. Dr. Tim Flannery is an Australian mammalogist, paleontologist, and environmentalist, and professor, and global warming activist. He was named Australian of the Year in 2007. The moderator is Greg Dalton, who is the founder of Climate One. In this interview, Flannery explains that over the last 10,000 years, humanity has built a superorganism, a level of organization similar to that of ants, termites, or bees. And the glue that holds the superorganism together is the division of labor and interdependence. As we form this one great superorganism, where we are all interconnected, we gain the capacity to deal with the environmental challenges. Flannery sees international progress in addressing climate change and expects more in the future.
How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. I'm Greg Dalton, founder of Climate One. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Tim Flannery, author of Here on Earth, A Natural History of the Planet. Dr. Flannery is an internationally acclaimed scientist, explorer, conservationist, credited for discovering more than 30 new species of mammals. He's also the author of several books, including the critically acclaimed Weathermakers. Dr. Flannery is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and the Times Literary Supplement. He'll give a presentation here for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have a conversation, including your questions. So please welcome Tim Flannery.
Thanks so much for that kind introduction, Greg, and it's great to see you all here this evening. The last time I spoke at the Commonwealth Club, it was just before the Copenhagen meeting, and I was chair of the Copenhagen Climate Council at that time. A lot of water's passed under the bridge since then, and one of the things I wanted to do this evening was just give an update on how we are doing as a species in terms of rising to this great challenge of addressing climate change. But before I do that, I wanted to talk briefly about the book, Here on Earth, that I've been talking about for the last month around the country. It really arose out of questions that were asked of me over the last, decade, really, about what humanity's future is. And people would often frame it a bit like, well, what chance is there that we're going to overcome this climate problem? What about the human population problem, the emerging food crisis, the water crisis, the energy crisis, a whole lot of problems we're facing this decade and this century? And the only way I could think really of trying to give an adequate answer for that question was to go back to the beginning, go back to the basics of the process that formed us and our world, because it's where we intersect with the planet that the problems arise, the problems of sustainability arise. That quest took me back to Charles Darwin and his great insight that all of the diversity of life on Earth has been formed by this evolutionary process, evolution by natural selection. It's a really simple idea. It's just that in any population there is variation between individuals. Some of those individuals will find themselves better suited to the conditions that they're living in than others, and they'll leave more offspring, and that over the vastness of geological time, that has created all of the diversity we see around us. I was particularly interested in pursuing Darwin's idea in terms of this book, because it seems to me that at the basis of a lot of our problems is a misunderstanding of what evolution by natural selection has to teach us. Within 5 years of Darwin publishing that seemingly innocent idea, people were already starting to talk about things like survival of the fittest, nature being red in tooth and claw, all of these analogies that were being applied directly to our society. And of course, Darwin's book, published in 1859 on the Origin of Species, bore a most unfortunate subtitle. It included the phrase, "and on the preservation of favoured races." Now, if I was going into a bookshop in 1859 in Britain and saw a book with a title like "On the Preservation of Favoured Races," I don't think I'd be thinking about worms that were just slightly better at being worms. You know, that's what Darwin meant by, you know, favoured races. I'm sure I would have been thinking about the British Empire builders out in India and the victorious British upper class, the industrialists that seemed to be the pinnacle of human evolution at the time. And of course, with that view that this was a survival of the fittest world, a number of social agendas were kicked off, and they range from the emergence of national socialism in Germany in the early 20th century through to the proliferation of eugenic societies around the planet at that time. And I think they had a deep impact as well on our more general thinking. You know, the neoclassical economics with its insistence that a truly free and unregulated market is in the best interest of humanity seems to me too to have roots in that sort of thinking, that this, in this survival of the fittest world, you grab what you can now, otherwise someone's going to grab it off you. But is that really what Darwin taught us? The more I thought about it, the more I realised that could not be the case. That this is not a survival of the fittest world. This is a world where evolution has spawned extraordinary interrelationships, interactions, and co-evolutionary outcomes. I started to think about my own body. I mean, you know, on my skin, I have hundreds of species of fungus and bacteria and viruses. And I do wash even though I'm an Aussie, so it's not that I don't wash, but it's just that us human beings have thousands of other species living on and in us. And we can't survive without them. You know, if my skin were truly sterilized, my health would be compromised. If I lost my gut flora, I'd be in very serious trouble. And that's been shown recently by medical science, people studying some of the larger co-inhabitants of our body. Hookworm is a good example. You know, hookworm we've often thought of as a disease or a parasite. We're now learning that if you eliminate hookworm, you can fall prey to diseases such as Crohn's disease, and which is an autoimmune response to a lack of our immune system being challenged. In fact, you can go on the internet right now and buy hookworm eggs if you've got Crohn's disease and cure yourself of the condition. So they're important, and the take-home lesson is that just me standing in front of you, I mean, 10% of my body by weight is other species. We are all ecosystems of near-planetary complexity, and it all tends towards homeostasis, towards keeping us alive and keeping the system going. The Earth has some of the same properties as our own body, you know, and what evolution's legacy is, not the process, which is cruel and amoral without doubt, but the legacy of that process of evolution by natural selection is one of a competent, integrated, and functional planet. I want to talk briefly about our own species because I think we need to understand some of the changes that are happening in our civilization that bear on its relationship with the planet. We started 10,000 years ago as hunter-gatherers. People every bit as intelligent, if not more intelligent, than those living today, yet incapable of the great things that are happening in our civilization today. We, over the last 10,000 years, have built what I would loosely term a superorganism. It is a level of organization which is intermediate between that of an organism such as ourselves and an ecosystem. Ed Wilson, the great evolutionary biologist, is the expert in this area. And our superorganism is very much like an ant superorganism or a termite superorganism. After all, the termites started out life as cockroaches that discovered agriculture 100 million years ago. Yeah, and they built these very, very complex civilizations today. And we, just like the termites, have built great civilizations without the use of reason. You know, we've built them. These are evolutionary outcomes. And the ants, the termites and the bees all have something to teach us. You know, One thing we learn is that the part of the glue that holds superorganisms together is the division of labour, and that's been incredibly important in our human civilizations. And what happens as we divide labour between us is that we create an ever more powerful civilization or superorganism, but that we as individuals become more dependent one upon the other. Right. So one way of sort of summarising that is as the superorganism grows in power, so the individual loses autonomy. You know? I don't even cook most of my meals anymore. I get someone else to cook them for me, right? So we become interdependent upon one another. That means that the survival of the superorganism becomes all important to us. It delivers almost all the amenity in our lives today. Yeah. So we can't afford to bankrupt the planet as a group. And this superorganism is becoming ever more connected. Just over the last 15 years, we've seen, you know, with 3.3 billion mobile phones on the planet and increasing number of people having access to the internet, that the individual has become mightily empowered. And we're seeing changes around the world as that occurs. We're seeing it in North Africa right now, in the Middle East right now. As we form this one great superorganism where we are all intimately interconnected, I think we gain the capacity to deal with a lot of environmental challenges in rather unexpected ways at times. And I just want to, before I go on and discuss how we're dealing with things, particularly the climate issue, I just want to make a couple of key points. One is that information systems tend to organise matter. So the DNA that is the blueprint of my body is an information system. It's a digital information system. It's organised the matter of my body as we see it now. At the global level, the DNA of all living things have profoundly altered Earth. They've made it a living planet in a very, very profound way. You know, nothing about the planet that we see is uninfluenced by life. Over the top, the skin. You know, the scientists have recently speculated that even the continental rocks beneath our feet have resulted from energy inputs from life, in part. So that's a very important thing to understand. The other thing that we need to understand in terms of us as a species, people will often say, well, us humans, we're just too greedy and selfish to act as any sort of global intelligence for planet Earth. I don't think that's true. We only need to look at our own bodies for an example of a greedy, selfish organ that is very good at running our bodies, our brain. Our brain weighs 2% of our body mass, yet it takes 20% of all of the energy we get from our food. It's a really greedy organ, yeah? And just interesting, by the way, that, you know, the global energy budget that's harvested by living things is about 100 terawatts. Humans are using about 16 terawatts of energy, so the ratio of us to the planet in terms of energy requires about the same as what the brain gets, about 20%. And the brain is very selfish. It will cut off supplies of oxygen and nutrients to every other organ in the body before it deprives itself of one iota of what it needs to run. And yet it's self-regulating. Yeah, it knows the one thing it can't do is bankrupt the system upon which it depends. And it's interesting that us humans are becoming self-regulating for all of our selfishness. The UN population projection figures that came out today illustrate that. We are heading for a population now of around 9.3 billion mid-century. It's a very big number, but by then virtually the entire human species will have passed through the demographic transition and will have limited its family size. That's the hallmark of a great command and control system, the fact that it can be self-regulating. So there is hope for us, I think, as a species in terms of playing a more positive role in the Gaian ecosystem. And perhaps, you know, if we take the very long view, we can see the day that might arise when humans will be a true global intelligence for the planet, when through our nervous system, if you want, which is everything from our agricultural systems through to satellite surveillance and so forth, we will be integrated into the Earth system in a way that makes it more productive and more stable rather than being a force for the negative. But that is a long way into the future if we look at that. To return to the climate problem, it is no doubt the greatest threat that humanity faces today. So what evidence is there that we are making any progress at all in this area? I chaired the Copenhagen Climate Council for 3 years and saw the great expectations that existed in society in the lead up to the meeting at Copenhagen. It was the biggest meeting of heads of government ever to have occurred in the history of our species. So the biggest meeting of leaders of government ever. Over what? Over climate, yeah? We didn't get a global treaty out of the meeting, and those of us who were close to the process knew many months out that that was an unlikely outcome, but there was raised expectations in the community, and so in the wake of the Copenhagen meeting, people were very disappointed. But we did, we know now, get something very valuable out of that meeting, and that is the Copenhagen Accord, forged with the help of your President Obama. It wouldn't have happened without him. That accord has now seen nations responsible for 80% of global emissions pledging reductions to be achieved by 2020. Lord Stern has calculated that if all of those pledges are honoured, we will have about two-thirds of the emissions reductions that we need to be on trajectory to avoid dangerous climate change. So that's a great positive. We, when we disbanded the Council in 2010, understood how important it was that nations honour those commitments. So we have gone back, by and large, to our nations and are working there to make sure that our countries honour their commitment. I'm now Australia's Chief Climate Commissioner, in part to help my country honour the commitment it's made to reduce its emissions by 5% below 2000 levels by 2020. A lot is happening in that space. China is forging ahead with reducing emissions intensity, growing its green economy. It is also trialling, we learned just last month, trialling emissions trading schemes. Seven regional schemes are being trialled, and there is in-depth negotiations going on now between the Europeans and the Chinese about the possibility of forming one global emissions trading scheme. In other words, China joining the EU ETS. If that happens, we have a global trading scheme of enormous power. Other countries are doing a lot as well. India is a good example. The poorest of the G20 countries has a tax on carbon now and a very, very fulsome energy efficiency program being unfolded. Even in this country where it's so easy to lose hope about things, you have a target of minus 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. You've already achieved minus 9%. Now, part of that's due to the economic slowdown, part of it's due to other government programs kicking in. And I met President Obama's climate advisor just the week before last, and he was cautiously confident that this country would reach its target. So there is hope in all of this. What we've pledged under Copenhagen is not enough, but it is a good first step. And we have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge there's hope. But there is not a moment for complacency, because the struggle ahead of us is going to get ever steeper in the next commitment period.
Kill. but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
And now for something completely different.